Well, thank you for joining us on Holy Family Radio for Faith and Reason, where we connect culture and ideas to the daily lives of Catholics. I'm your host, Dr. John Pinero. My day job is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids. But I'm here on Holy Family Radio, and today we're talking with Dr. Samuel Gregg about his newest book, Tea Party Catholic, The Catholic Case for Limited Government, a Free Economy, and Human Flourishing. Dr. Gregg is Director of Research at the Acton Institute. He has written and spoken extensively on questions of political economy, economic history, ethics and finance, and natural law theory. He's the author of many books, including the prize-winning The Commercial Society, and more recently, Becoming Europe. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hello, John. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Good to have you. Now, I guess I'd like to start us off just by asking about your Tea Party Catholic book, and what, after writing so many books on European history and freedom in general and political economy in general, and I would say your really excellent book on Wilhelm Röpke, what led you to write what seems to be your most American book to date, Tea Party Catholic?
Well, there's many reasons. The book itself has nothing to do with the Tea Party movement itself. The main reason for writing the book was it seemed to me that the Catholic case for limited government and a free economy grounded in what I call human flourishing needed to be made in a fresh way to American audiences, particularly American Catholic audiences, because there are so many things happening in the United States in the economy and with regard to the role of the state and with regard to things about how we discuss the nature of freedom and liberty. I thought that the time had come to make a restatement of these claims in order to take into account many of the things that have happened in the United States since 2008, because debates about how free the economy should be, the role of government in the economy, but also the moral basis for economic life, it did seem to me that these needed to be restated, to be refreshed, and to be argued drawing upon sources that some American Catholics, I suspect, aren't terribly familiar with. So thus in the book, there's a strong emphasis upon natural law argumentation, but I also draw upon more recent encyclicals that have been written by the popes, and perhaps above all in some respects, I draw upon the thought of the only Catholic who signed the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll of Carrollton. And I draw upon him because, A, he's a founder, B, he was a very serious Catholic, and C, because he thought very carefully about these issues of the nature of government, the role of the economy, the nature of business, and even very technical matters like monetary policy. He also played a significant role in the legislature, in Congress, but also in his home state of Maryland. He was probably, I would argue, one of the most well-educated of all the founders. He was also very well-versed, not just in successful business practice. He was, after all, the richest man in America at the time of the Revolutionary War.
Wow.
But he was also someone who understood how economies worked, and more or less, I think, as I argue in my book, Tea Party Catholic, articulated a vision of the economy that we would describe today as more or less free market. So those are the reasons that caused me to write the book. And I suppose the the vindication, if one could call it that, has been the immense demand that there has been for the book from all sorts of audiences, which has been very refreshing. But it also tells me that this Catholic case for limited government, a free economy, was in need of restating for the beginning of the 21st century, especially for American Catholic audiences, but also hopefully so that Catholics outside the United States might understand why American Catholics are more skeptical of government intervention, why American Catholics are more skeptical of things like welfare states, and why they trust more in entrepreneurship and free enterprise than, for example, Catholics in Western Europe or Latin America.
I think I would like to get to the distinctive American contributions, not just to Europe, but to Catholicism and Catholic thought in general, but if we could go back to Carroll for a little bit, maybe it's me, the historian, but Pauline Maier, I'm sure you're familiar with her work on the Constitution and the founding period. She had a fairly low view, I would say, of Carroll, saying that his fame was just the product of an historical accident. That is, since he died in the early 1830s and was the last signer of the Declaration of Independence to die, that this was the only reason he was famous. But I couldn't disagree more, and I know you couldn't disagree more either. I do assign at Aquinas College Brad Berzer's book, American Cicero. And Berzer sees Carroll as very much an aristocrat. And I thought maybe we could explore Carroll a little bit more then. I'm not sure people nowadays who would think in terms of freedom or even freedom of the libertarian variety would understand how such an aristocratic type like Carroll could be so important for delineating the lines of American freedom and religious liberty.
Well, there's where does one start? First of all, I think it's very important to keep in mind, as I said before, that Carroll was, I would argue, maybe the best educated of all the American founders. Maybe Witherspoon was probably slightly better educated, but Carroll was sent away at a very young age to Europe, where he studied at St. Omer's, which was the Jesuit college in modern-day Belgium. He was extremely well-educated according to the Jesuit scholastic method that was in vogue at the time. He then went to the very prestigious College of Saint-Louis-le-Grand in Paris, where he took his degree. He then spent considerable time living in England, where he learned common law. So basically, this is a man who had extremely deep and broad formation in what we might call the Western tradition. And this is a little different to a lot of the other founders because, of course, he's very exposed to the specifically Catholic dimension of all that. So I think that's one very important thing to bear in mind. And when one looks at the way that he argued and talked in the public square, in the colonies, and then in the emergent United States, it's very clear that he brought many of these classical, Enlightenment and above all Catholic insights to bear upon many of the political debates that were occurring at the time. So, for example, he was very insistent that the state of Maryland had to have two chambers of a legislature rather than just one, because he was very concerned that just a one single chamber could be a recipe for populism. He also, I think, took the view that the responsibilities of the citizen went beyond just voting, that they had to be someone who was informed and participatory in the political process. And it was very important for well-educated and wealthy people like himself, he believed, to be involved in that process. But he also, I think, contributed mightily when it came to making sure that this new American Republic took a number of things very seriously. One, of course, was economic freedom. During the Revolutionary War, for example, he corresponded with many of the other founders of the United States, and he spent a lot of time explaining to them why things like price controls are a really bad idea, or why diluting the currency via simply printing money is also a very bad economic idea. He basically explained these things to Benjamin Franklin, who, of course, was no intellectual slouch himself.
Right.
Another thing which I think is the other freedom which he was very insistent upon was religious liberty. Now, this was partly obviously because, as a Catholic living in Maryland in the 18th century, he was subject, he and his family, to all sorts of legal forms of discrimination because he was a Catholic. He couldn't vote, he couldn't sit in the legislature, and he was very determined to make sure that the new American Republic embodied a robust conception of religious liberty. In fact, when George Washington, who was a very good friend of the Carroll family even before the Revolution, when George Washington was asking him, pressing Charles Carroll, why are you with us? Why are you fighting with us for liberty? And he said, for religious freedom. He was very, very clear about that. And so I think that was particularly important when it came to the debates that went on about what religious freedom would mean, its extent, its robustness, And I think that's extremely important when it comes to today. And I think also in that regard, Carroll's very important because he was always very insistent that freedom in a sense is indivisible, that you can't suppress freedom in one area without expecting it to be negatively affected in other areas. And that's a quite Catholic insight, I think, that is very important. So while I think there is this temptation to look at Carroll as important because he was the last signer of the Declaration of Independence to die, I think when one looks at what he did in the economy, in business, when it came to working with the other founders, his role in Congress, his role in the legislature in Maryland, his role in terms of pushing the case for economic liberty and religious liberty, all of that, I think, makes him quite a significant figure. And I have to say, I'm rather surprised that more American Catholics don't know more about him. It's extraordinary to me. When I was researching this book and I found all this material, some of which has been looked at by scholars, but of course when you get to the broader American community, it's as if he doesn't exist.
How do you explain?
They don't know about him at all.
How do you explain that? Do you have any explanation for it? There's so many forgotten founders.
That, in the 19th century, the way that the founding was portrayed was in a very Protestant sense. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but this is how a lot of the founding was portrayed by people writing in the 19th century. And Carroll, of course, doesn't fit into that narrative. And when it comes to the 20th century, and you see some of these much more explicitly secular or even secularist interpretations of the founding emerge, then a Catholic like Carroll fits into that narrative even less.
Right.
And we, of course, Catholics in America, we're just as subject to that sort of broad Protestant and now what you'd call broad secular interpretation of the American founding. And so it's not surprising that our view of the founding in some respects reflects that Protestant/secular understanding of the founding.
I mean, I think that's exactly the way I would explain it, too. Historically, you know, my understanding of the 1780s and 90s is that at least under the Articles of Confederation, the first constitution the United States had, there were several states that had anti-Catholic laws on the books. And John Jay, our first Chief Justice, was one of the leaders in wanting those in New York. But those started to die away, but there were established churches on into the 1830s. But Catholicism was seen as this type of threat where limiting it would actually ensure freedom. And so we get the Protestant story first, then the Enlightenment story second, and now I guess you're telling the real story, huh?
Well, I guess what my book is trying to say in that regard is that there is a Catholic dimension to the American founding, which Catholics neglect at their peril, but also in the sense of neglecting their place today in the American experiment in ordered liberty. I think it's really about not saying that somehow it was an entirely Catholic thing, because that would of course not be true.
Right.
Or that the Enlightenment didn't exert an influence, because of course it did. But that there were Catholics, not just Charles Carroll, but also his brother John Carroll, as well as Daniel Carroll of Rock Creek, all of whom played a very significant role at key points of the Revolution. So, of course, Charles Carroll and his brother John, who was a priest, were among the congressional delegates sent to negotiate with the French Canadians in Quebec in order to try and get them to join the Revolution. Why were they sent? Because the French Canadians were Catholic. And so the Continental Congress said, well, we need some American Catholics who can talk to these people. But also, I think, keeping in mind that Catholics at this point were maybe 35,000 people in a continent at the beginning of the Revolution that numbered maybe 4 to 5 million. So they're a tiny minority. But in terms of punching above their weight, I think that's certainly the case. And it's also true, I think, to say that the Catholic community, generally speaking, was overwhelmingly on the side of those who were pursuing the Revolution. And that could not be said of all the other religious communities in the United States at the time.
Well, Catholics seem to have only to gain from the Revolution, particularly in Maryland.
Oh, yes, and I also think that they saw it. Charles Carroll in particular, and this comes out in some of his correspondence and some of his Reflections, saw the revolution as a once-in-a-lifetime chance to establish religious liberty, not just for Catholics, but for other religious minorities in the United States, a once-in-a-lifetime chance that might not come along, because we have to remember that religious liberty in the sense that, say, the Second Vatican Council understands that term, was very much the exception rather than the norm in Europe and North America and Latin America and, in fact, the rest of the world at the time.
Now, I'd like to make a comment about the Enlightenment. You have a great section of your book. It's page 55 where you talk about how many citations at the Continental Congress or at the Constitutional Convention, et cetera, and just how often the Bible was cited compared to, say, Locke or even Montesquieu. And I think Montesquieu was probably the most cited philosopher, at least, but it's really the Bible that comes out on top. So maybe in a general way, we might speak to what Protestants and Catholics had in common, because they seem to be drawing on the Bible, according to your research, more than anything else when they start talking about religious liberty and really freedom in general.
Yes, and we shouldn't be surprised by that, because even though there was a significant Enlightenment influence upon the American founding, mainly in the form of the thinkers like John Locke, but also people like David Hume, I think we need to remember that overwhelmingly Americans at the time were believing Christians of one form or another. There were people like Jefferson, who was, I think, more or less a deist, and people like Franklin, who fell into the same category. But if you look at the majority of the founders and the signers, most of them are believing Christians with different levels of religious practice. But for them, the Bible was simply part of the everyday culture in which everyone lived, moved, and had their being. To quote scripture in that type of context, even in the context of constitutional debates, would not have seemed odd. In fact, it would have seemed odd if these things were not referenced. So I think that's very important, because it makes us hesitate before we say that secular Enlightenment thought is somehow the cornerstone of the American founding and the American Revolution. Were they influential, those ideas? Yes, but I think their influence has been much exaggerated. And even people who came to the United States looking from the outside, people like Jacques Maritain, the famous French Catholic philosopher, when he looked at the founders' writings, he quickly saw, he said, you know, these are not metaphysicians, these are not theologians, but it's very clear that their way of thinking about government, their understanding of natural law, et cetera, is all shaped in a very big way by commitments to Christian faith and the idea of Christian revelation. So I think this is very important, particularly today, because, well, as a historian, you know this better than I, the dominant narrative about the American Revolution is this, this primarily Enlightenment thing, and that people like Washington and others were very, very skeptical and distant towards religion. It's just not true. It's just not true. So that's not just a lesson for Catholics today, but it's also a lesson for other Christians who have been, in some respects, misled into thinking that somehow the American Revolution is an entirely secular thing. Now, we don't want to go to the other side and say that, well, the American Revolution was a sort of Christian uprising. No, that's not true either. But I think we do need to rebalance our interpretation of the revolution so that Catholics and evangelicals and other religious groups in the United States can say, yes, this is just as much part of our story in the United States as it is those who adhere to a more or less secularist view.
I think one of the most common questions I get from both from students at Aquinas, but also when I get public lectures on somebody like Washington, they always want to know, was Washington a Christian? Was
right.
Jefferson really a deist? Were the founders Christians? And I guess I would think along lines the same way you do, and that I would say, well, I if we measure them up to the creeds, we could say, well, you know, Washington didn't go to church on Communion Sunday for a reason. The pastor had asked him to stay away. He didn't go to communion. Maybe that was some kind of scandal, but Martha went. But what I would say is that their world was so there was just dripping with Christianity, and so they, even in their day, evangelicals might have looked lowly at them, but nowadays they would seem more Christian than I think many people walking around. I mean, people, even churchgoers, right?
Right?
They were just their way of looking at the world and their reaction to other people and their talk and their the things they talk about.
Sure. Right. Another thing which I think is quite important here is that the way at the time of the American founding, the way that many of the colonists in the United States, people like Washington, people like Charles Carroll, people like Adams, the way they talked about religion was in a restrained way. This is particularly true of Anglicans, people like George Washington, for example. Everything about religion, it was there, it was important. We know that Washington prayed. We know that he didn't exhibit any hostility towards religion. He was, of course, very careful in the way that he talked about it. But that wasn't uncommon for Anglicans living in Virginia at the time. That was just simply the way that they referred, that they lived their faith and talked about these things. But Michael Novak, I think, wrote a book called Washington's God, which I think provides the best account of how to situate someone like Washington at his time. And in fact, he goes through and says that the way that Washington talked about religion, the way he talked about God, the language of providence, it's all imbued with what Novak argues is more or less a Judeo-Christian understanding of these things and not at all a deistic watchmaker understanding of God that may have been embraced by someone like a Benjamin Franklin. So I think this is very important in terms of correctly situating the place of religion in the founding and the lives of the founders, because by the beginning of the 18th century, you see evangelicalism and coming to the fore and people talking very explicitly about being saved by Jesus Christ, et cetera, et cetera. That's just a very different way of talking about Christ and religion than the founding generation of the United States. It didn't mean that they were less religious or even less Christian. It was just a different way of talking about these things.
That's a fine point to make. And that's Novak's book is a good little book on Washington. I remember I was actually working at the George Washington papers at the University of Virginia when he was writing that. And he would, when I was doing a little research for him, and he told me, he said, "Oh, you're moving to Grand Rapids. You should look at my friend, Father Robert Sirico." And so I did. That was one of the first things I did in town here. Well, I'd like to switch gears a little bit from talking about the founding as much as I'd like to continue that conversation and talk about one of the great themes of your book, which is connecting religious liberty to economic freedom, and maybe sort of bring us towards the contemporary times here a bit more. You mentioned that the end of freedom is the key. This is what we need to know. But that, unlike the founding generation, the appreciation of why freedom matters is lacking. And I wonder, is it long habit under the welfare state? Why is appreciation of freedom lacking? It seems to me that appreciation of libertinism is not lacking. Appreciation of fulfilling my desires, if at all possible, and if the state can help, that's great, is not lacking. But real freedom, maybe that's lacking.
Well, that, I think, is ultimately traceable, and I talk about this in Tea Party Catholic a great deal. A lot of these ideas, some of these conflicting understandings of freedom, these are not new conflicts. In fact, I talk in the book about how in the Middle Ages you had people arguing about the nature of freedom, and you had people like Aquinas talking about that the end of freedom, the purpose of freedom, is human excellence, the flourishing in the theological and cardinal virtues, whereas you had people like William of Ockham, who was a Franciscan teaching in Oxford in the Middle Ages, who basically took the view that, no, freedom is about exercising my will. The end to which I choose, the purpose that I'm choosing is actually irrelevant. What matters is simply that I'm free to choose. And this debate about the nature of freedom has been going on for a very, 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 very long time. And it even precedes the Middle Ages. It goes back to For example, the famous debates that went on, at least through written word, between what you might call the Aristotelian side of the Greek world and the Epicurean side of the Greek world. So this is not a new thing. What is different, I suspect, is that at least in much of the West today, the Epicurean view or the Occamite view of freedom tends to be in the ascendancy, at least among good numbers of the culture-shaping institutions of Western Europe and the United States today. So that means that public discussion of freedom tends to be in terms of the way that you described it. How do I satisfy my desires? And the role of the state is to be there to make sure that I get to get what I want. It doesn't matter what I want, it's just as long as I choose it. That's the most important thing, consistent with other people getting whatever the hay it is that they happen to want. And I would say that after the Second Vatican Council, some of that thinking sneaked into quite a large segment of the Catholic world, at least in Western Europe and the United States. And you can see this in some of the Catholic theologians who are writing in the immediate aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, where you see this implicitly Occamite view of freedom. They don't call it that, but that's what it is, starting to sneak into the teaching of theology, particularly moral theology. Now, I think in the Catholic community, that trend has been reversed, at least intellectually. For all sorts of reasons, such as the fact that it's ultimately incoherent, it is ultimately inconsistent with the Christian understanding of the person, and also that it just doesn't make sense. We have a little way to go, but I think that within the church, at least, the right understanding of freedom is prevailing, but that is not true in the broader secular society. I think that Occamite vision of freedom as desire has more or less triumphed in the mainline Protestant world. In the evangelical world, I think there's more appreciation for liberty as self-government and liberty as directed towards human flourishing. But in the secular world, of course, the Occamite view is absolutely regnant, both on the right, the secular right, and on the secular left, I might add as well. And why this matters is that I think it actually, rather than constraining the state, it tends to turn the state into an enabler of this type of vision of the human person and this understanding of the nature of freedom. And it means that conceptions of freedom attached to human flourishing get swept aside. And you see this, I think, happening when it comes to this connection between economic liberty and religious liberty that I'm talking about. And you know, let's talk, for example, about the HHS mandate thing. What's going on there? Well, in one sense, it reflects the general expansion of the welfare state into the economy. That's one thing that's going on. But you have to remember that the welfare state today, the modern secular welfare state, its vision of the human person is very much an Occamite, a motivist, I need to get what I want to fulfill my desires, whatever they are, vision of the person. That is what informs the vision of the welfare state. Now, the implication for religious liberty is that religious liberty becomes suddenly very unimportant. It gets relegated down to a sixth or seventh level degree of concern, because if religious liberty, my religious liberty to live in accordance with the creeds of my faith, gets in the way of someone else's desire to sterilize their husband or wife, or to get free access to abortion-inducing drugs, et cetera, well, religious liberty, that gets swept aside and just gets reduced to freedom of worship. And we see this in the way that a lot of public officials today talk about freedom of religion. It's not about freedom of religion in the sense I live my life according to the claims of my faith in a way that's consistent with the ability of everyone else to do so. No, freedom of religion becomes freedom to worship, which means I get to do what I want inside church or mosque or synagogue on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. But outside that, I'm subjected to this, frankly, very authoritarian expression of this freedom as doing whatever I want.
Yeah, as Justice Scalia once put it, I think, he said it's like you have to do it in the privacy of your own room. He said that from the secular standpoint, it's like a religion and pornography are going to be equated. This is something you have to do in the shadows.
Yes, and of course, as you would know, John, this is utterly contrary to any reasonable interpretation of the First Amendment. It's also completely contrary to the vision of the founders, ranging from people like Washington to Charles Carroll to even Thomas Jefferson. I mean, their vision of religion is religious liberty is not this freedom of religion. It's all about privacy, et cetera, et cetera. No, it's about creating space for people to live out in the fullness, the beliefs and moral convictions of their faith in a way that's consistent with the freedom of other people to do so. And that's very much the understanding of religious liberty that you find in Dignitatis Humanae, the Second Vatican Council's Declaration on Religious Freedom. It's not about freedom of worship. It's about the freedom of individuals and communities to live out their faith consistent with the freedom of others to do so, and the way that that's mediated is through natural law. And that's it's not exactly the same as the American founding, but it's darn close to it.
Can you tell me what you mean by that, about maybe elaborate a bit on the relationship of natural law to this? I think our listeners would, you know, if you listen to Jay Budashevsky and other scholars, they talk about natural law, and if people don't believe in it, or if it's so buried under other things and other mores, is this really what we want to turn to as Catholics to put our positions into the public square, believing that if they're true, the truth will win out, the truth will set you free, we're created to know the truth, so let's tell it. But natural law seems a difficult road.
Well, there's no doubt that, in my mind, that when you use the phrase natural law today in much of the United States, but even it's even worse in Europe, people have no idea what you're talking about, or they think that you mean Darwinism. That's what they think you mean. But no, natural law is simply reason's capacity to recognize transcendental, metaphysical, and moral truths about what we should do and what we should not do. It's expressed in things like the Ten Commandments. It's expressed in things like St. Paul's observation that even the Gentiles can know what's wrong because of the law of God that's imprinted on their heart, etc., etc. Now, part of the issue today is that understanding of natural law is not well grasped, especially I'd have to say in the academy. It's not well grasped in the academy.
I would agree with you there.
It's just not. Even in some Catholic institutions, it's just not well grasped. It's often seen as a specifically Catholic thing, which of course, by definition, it's not. I mean, Aristotle was not a Catholic. He wasn't even a Christian. Maimonides, who was the great Jewish natural law philosopher, was Jewish. He wasn't Catholic or Christian. But it seems to me that when you're having public debates about some rather fundamental questions, then if you don't have a natural law way of discussing and reasoning through these things, and natural law is not just in terms of what you should and shouldn't do, but it's also a way of thinking consistently with the demands of reason, in other words, with logic, what is correct ways of reasoning. If you don't have that, then the alternative is, frankly, brute force. And the brute force occurs either through the barrel of a gun or through, I have more people voting for me than you, so you might be right, but it doesn't matter because I have more people voting for me than you do. And you end up in this position whereby you end up defaulting to, well, it's whoever has the most power. And so natural law is very important because it's really the only alternative to having reasoned discussion about any number of controversial issues. It's the only alternative to just settling these matters through brute force or soft force. And that's why I think it's particularly important to revive today. And of course, it was something that the American founders were very familiar with. Now, you know, there's different schools of natural law. There's people like Locke who talked a lot more about natural rights and they talked about natural law. But the language of natural law, the idea that reason could know truth, that there were laws of logic that needed to be followed if you were going to reason seriously and consistently, this was not at all something strange for the founders. They used this, invoked this language of the law of nations or the natural law or the law of nature all the time. And it seems to me that it's really the only alternative out there, particularly in pluralistic societies where you may not be able to agree about who Jesus Christ was, but you can agree that this is a reasonable way of thinking through problems, and that is an incoherent way of thinking through problems. And it seems to me that part of the issue is that after the Second Vatican Council, at least within the Catholic Church, natural law went into somewhat of an eclipse. I think in more recent decades it has come back because more and more people realize that, it, especially Catholics, that this is the way that you need to make public arguments, because the only alternative is to do what skeptics do, or those who describe themselves as pragmatists, which is simply to cobble together temporary majorities to get what you want rather than what's reasonable.
Another difficulty I think you face in making this argument for not just the religious liberty, which I hope is more attractive to more Catholics than few Catholics, but also the economic freedom argument, which we can talk about next in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's this difficulty there that the social justice Catholics, as you term them, seem to have largely won the argument among Catholics since the Second Vatican Council. But even it seems in the years leading up to the Second Vatican Council as well. So I'm wondering how we Catholics could go for so long, and the Church go for so long, without the prudent arguments you make for economic freedom. I mean, why are they so in the background? Why are they so buried under the social justice Catholic argument of the kind we received from, let's say, from the American bishops during the 1980s?
Where do we start? Well, I think
that's a big question.
Let's just say, let's just go through this systematically. One, I think the first thing is that there is, of course, social justice is a part of Catholic teaching. But what many Catholics, I should say, understand by social justice is not what the Church understands by social justice. Now, it doesn't help that the Church's teaching about social justice, especially as expressed in social encyclicals and in the compendium of social doctrine, isn't the most clearly expressed. It's not very clearly expressed. So I think one of the things I do in my book is explain this is what social justice actually is. And guess what? It turns out that social justice is not a warrant for the state to do whatever it wants in the economy. And in fact, there's a dimension of social justice which focuses upon the responsibilities that we as individuals and as a church and as communities of civil society, our responsibilities, the things that we should be doing to address problems of social injustice around us before we automatically leap to the state. So that's one thing. I think there's been some fundamental misconceptions of what social justice is. In the 1980s, I think it's true to say that with many of the statements that were produced by the American Catholic bishops, the understanding of social justice that you find in those texts tends to make that equivalence between social justice and government action. And I think that's very problematic because I don't think it's consistent with Catholic tradition, it's not consistent with reason, and it's not consistent with the understanding of human flourishing that I try to articulate in the book. I think things have gotten a lot better since then, by the way. I think the bishops are much more careful about getting into these issues because they understand that it's very much, most economic issues are, of course, a matter for prudential judgment. We can disagree about how big we think the state should be or what should be the state size of GDP among ourselves as Catholics, in a way that we can't disagree when it comes to something like the impermissibility of liberalizing laws regarding something like abortion or euthanasia.
Right. I think you make a pretty strong statement in your book, something like, look, if you're a Catholic, if you're a Christian, you have to love the poor, right? If you say, I'm a Christian, I don't love the poor, well, then you're not a Christian,
right.
you're not Catholic. But how we do that is the key. And there's arguments from efficiency that you talk about. That is what really brings the poor out of poverty so that we don't have this category of the poor, but maybe we have people who are poor now and what is needed for them to flourish, et cetera. There's those efficiency arguments, but I think your human flourishing arguments are what you're really grounding the book in. And I'd have to say as a Catholic reader of your book, Tea Party Catholic, I really appreciate that. That is, we hear arguments all the time about, teach a person to fish, right? Well, okay, but what's that going to do for them as a human person? How is this going to help them reach their final end in God?
That's really the key because, in fact, people like me who are inclined to support free markets, I think we are usually terrible when it comes to making substantive arguments for these institutions of freedom. We're very good at making efficiency arguments. We're superb at making efficiency arguments. But we are terrible when it comes to making arguments based upon substantive conceptions of human flourishing. And I think a lot of free marketers fall into this problem of simply arguing from efficiency because they don't have a good conception of human flourishing, or they really do believe in liberation through materialism, or they're more or less utilitarians. And I think the Catholic case for things like business, for commerce, for looking to markets as the way to get people out of poverty, it's not just that these things work, and that's one of the things I think Michael Novak very much contributed to, was this pointing to empirical evidence about how we deal with poverty and how the failures of the welfare state and the fact that markets are what basically gets people out of poverty, without turning, of course, into an empiricist. I think Novak was extremely important in making these arguments. And then we need to take that a step further and say that not only do these things get people out of poverty, but they enable them to flourish as God wants them to flourish. Because it's not just that you're no longer dependent upon the state. It's now that you are in a position to start acquiring certain virtues. You can start behaving in certain ways that in business, in commerce, in the marketplace, that contribute to your own flourishing, but also to the flourishing of other people as well.
Well, what are some ways the welfare state or state intervention in the economy would be a roadblock to me developing virtues? Let's say the virtue of temperance. We don't have to take that one, but just the kind of the traditional virtues. In what way would the state be a roadblock to that?
Well, I think the main problem with things like large welfare states is that it basically detaches your freedom from responsibility for yourself and others. I think that's really the problem. And in fact, we see this start to manifest itself among those populations in the United States that have been on welfare now for significant numbers of generations, sometimes three or four generations now. And what do we see? Well, we see all sorts of addictive behavior. We see all sorts of self-destructive behavior. We see the family being basically disintegrating in these communities. We see communities in this sense starting to disintegrate because no longer do they look to each other in the sense of looking, in the sense of being exercising solidarity by taking care of your family and your neighbor. Instead, you look to bureaucrats and the state to solve these sorts of problems. And this is an observation that just doesn't come from, quote-unquote, the right. There were people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who, of course, was a Catholic, although, let's say, a little loose on some of the fundamental social issues. But he pointed out in the late 1960s and early 1970s that the welfare state was doing enormous damage to the black community.
And was excoriated for it by the left.
Right, he was excoriated for it by the left, but the evidence that's come out now about how the welfare state causes people to no longer exercise responsibility, not just for their family and their friends, but even themselves. They don't take care of themselves anymore, and they look to this anonymous bureaucrats to solve their problems. Now, I am not saying that people who are in commerce or in trade or in business automatically become virtuous, or that there aren't enormous temptations that can arise in the context of a market economy which can lead to all sorts of unvirtuous behavior. I mean, consumerism, I think, is a real problem in wealthy societies. I'm not arguing that market-driven economies don't have their own temptations when it comes to the capacity of us to live lives of human flourishing. But the damage is so bad in welfare state-orientated societies in which government is seen as the first recourse for dealing with social problems. And it's striking to me in some respects that there are many Catholics, even many quite Orthodox Catholics, who haven't quite got the connection between these things.
So where we go from here is I'd like to take us to what Catholics can do, what they should read, what they should do in their daily lives. One of the themes of our show here, Faith and Reason, is to try to connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition, which we've been talking about here for quite some time, trying to connect that to daily life. So let's say I'm a Catholic man or woman, and I work hard, right? I don't have a lot of time in my day. I'm at work. I come home. I'm tired. I try to make dinner for tonight, lunch for tomorrow, etc. So I don't have the kind of time, let's say, a Charles Carroll has, or maybe a professor of history at Aquinas has. I don't have the time to read through these things. Where should I go? Besides, of course, I'm sure Tea Party Catholic. where should I go? What should I do? How can I behave? I don't want to. We'll stay away from the question of how should I vote. I think Carol was right about that. That we take democracy down to just this level of voting where we're lost among millions of other votes. But what about the kinds of things Tocqueville talks about? You know, community, etc. So maybe you have some advice for our listeners, places you can point them.
Sure. Well, at the risk of self-advertising, Tea Party Catholic is written for a broader audience than just scholars. And at the end of each chapter of Tea Party Catholic, I list further resources for people who want to dive deeper into questions like, okay, how does the welfare state really mess us up? Or what is really the root of an authentic understanding of religious liberty? So there's, in the book itself, Tea Party Catholic, there are further readings that are suggested for people who do have the time to be able to dive into these things. For those people who don't have the time, and that of course is probably most of us, I think there's a number of things. I think that the Catechism of the Catholic Church, when it talks about our responsibilities as citizens and as economic actors, I think the Catechism of the Catholic Church is very succinct and very clear on these matters, and in a way that not only reflects upon contemporary realities, but also grounds these things upon the deeper Catholic tradition, so Scripture, the Church Fathers, the Doctors of the Church, etc., etc. And it's also written in a very accessible way. So I would very, very much recommend that your listeners look at what the Catechism says about how one lives one's life in society as a citizen, as an economic actor. So that's one thing. I think another thing is to reflect upon the nature of whatever work it is that we are called to do. Some of us are called to work in business. Some of us are called to work in the academy. Others of us are called to be homemakers, to be homeschoolers, to be educators. And I think really understanding that work is very, very much the way that most of us spend a lot of our time, but also it shapes us as persons. So simply trying to live out the virtues in whatever line of work we are called to do, I think can be immensely transforming of our communities, of the church, and therefore hopefully of society as well. Now, it seems like, well, how do I, as a housewife, how do I shape the rest of society by living out my vocation to be a mother and a homemaker? Well, you won't necessarily see all the immediate effects of, or even the long-term effects of your living out this life virtuously, but your children will. And your children will pass it on to other people as well. So I think, or if you're in business, if you're an entrepreneur, understanding that the way I live my life as a business executive or as an entrepreneur or as a small businessman or as a financial executive, if I can live my life in accordance with the demands of the gospel and strive to show others how to live the virtues in the context of whatever it is my work happens to be, that too can have a transforming effect upon the way that people, for example, understand business or the way that we understand finance. And thirdly, I think another thing to do, and this is sort of a slightly more negative approach, is to think about all those things that we complain about in society. welfare dependency, too big government, unreliability of people who we do business with, and ask ourselves, okay, we complain about all of these things in the political order, in the social order, in the economy, even within our own families. But am I being consistent in making those critiques? In other words, am I actually living up to the principles that I think others should be living by? So it's a type of self-corrective mechanism. That's one of the things I have to say that I think Pope Francis in particular has pointed to when he talks a lot about the fact that we spend a lot of time worrying about other people's sins. And, you know, to an extent, we should worry about when our things like our spouse is doing the wrong thing or our children doing the wrong thing or our colleagues or even our acquaintances doing the wrong thing, because that's part of being concerned for their welfare. We don't pretend to them that somehow that what they're doing is okay because just simply because they've chosen it. But that's okay as long as, and this is one of the things I think Francis has been stressing, we constantly look at ourselves and say, am I being consistent with what I believe? Because I think all of us, because we're fallen creatures, because we do what Paul said, we know what we ought to do, but we constantly find ourselves doing the opposite, we need to keep checking ourselves. Am I being virtuous? Am I being just in the way that I treat people in business? Am I, for example, in the world of business? I don't like rent-seeking. I don't like people going after corporate welfare. But am I taking government contracts? Am I trying to get close to political leaders in order to secure things or subsidies from them while I condemn others for doing the same sort of thing? So that, I think, that's the third thing, this constant self-checking. I think
that's like a daily examination of conscience just in general, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, if for those of your listeners who are business people, there's a very good document that was put out, I think it was in early 2012, by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. And it's available online. It's called The Vocation of the Business Leader. And, you know, when I see something that's put out by an organization that has justice and peace in its name, I usually get very nervous. Very nervous, because it usually turns out to be some sort of mildly social democratic thing. But this document is superb because it really does take the idea of business as a vocation seriously. And it has at the back of it a whole range of questions to ask yourself as a business leader or an executive to check whether you're being consistent with what the Catholic understanding of business is. Am I being just to my employees? And it even says, am I being a rent seeker or am I actually creating wealth? These are really good things, I think, that people in business should be asking themselves. And I think you're right, that type of self-examination of conscience at the beginning and end of the day. Another thing I'd quickly suggest that people read is St. Francis de Sales' Introduction to a Devout Life. This was written back in the 16th/17th century by St. Francis de Sales, and it's written for people who are living lay vocations and sometimes quite important lay vocations. It's written for people who are important people in society and who face all sorts of different types of temptations, ranging from lust for power, lust for flesh, lust for money, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all about how you can live the Catholic life in the conditions of prosperity. And let's face it, you know, prosperity brings with it its own temptations, its own challenges.
Well, we've seen this with European countries like Ireland. I mean, countries that were once so solidly Catholic, and prosperity comes along, and what an amazing transformation in almost 10 or 15 years in Ireland. Not only due to prosperity, of course, but still amazing transformation.
Right. How do you live? I mean, that, I think, is really the challenge. I mean, poverty is obviously a challenge because there's poverty in the United States, there's poverty around the world. But the other end of the spectrum is, how do I continue to live the good life in conditions of material prosperity? Charles Carroll had a lot of thoughts about this matter, of course, because he was an incredibly successful businessman. He multiplied his family's holdings over several times, and yet he saw the effects of wealth upon his son, Charles Carroll of Homewood, who died before Charles Carroll of Carrollton did, who basically was an alcoholic and wife beater, and who didn't know how to handle great wealth. And so, you know, and Carroll himself was very critical of what he saw as often the frivolousness and the materialism that permeated much of Maryland high society at his time. So Charles Carroll had a lot of thoughts about this, and he said that disciplined work habits were part of the way that you combated these temptations. Now, he wasn't advocating some sort of Protestant work ethic. That's not what he was talking about. He was much more talking about, how do I live a life of detachment and sobriety and keeping my eye on the main prize, which, of course, is what we hope will be union with Christ in heaven, without getting distracted and literally consumed by the things that we own.
You're listening to Faith and Reason with Dr. John Panero, my guest, Dr. Samuel Gregg. We've been talking about his book, Tea Party Catholic, The Catholic Case for Limited Government, a Free Economy, and Human Flourishing. Sam, you've just given us, I think, a great list of things we as Catholics can do and read to be a part of what Pope Emeritus Benedict and others, and including you in your book, have called the creative minority, that this is what's needed to come into the culture of death and this culture that we have, and try to turn it around, try to save souls, but also try to let us see what our freedom is for. I think that's one of the questions maybe we Americans don't ask often enough, what our freedom is for. And you've given us a lot to think about today, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, and I hope people, if they pick the book up, it's readily available on Amazon.com. I think you'll find that many of the things that we've talked about today are expanded in more detail and hopefully relatively clearly.
Yes, I really enjoyed it. It not just a book on American Catholic thought, but the way you connect liberty and virtue and business, and it's a good history book too. You got a good bit of history in there, particularly on the founding period. One last question, just as we're on our way out here. You use the term Catholic American and not American Catholic, and I'm going to assume that's on purpose, and that's the way I usually use that terminology. In what I do. Was that on purpose?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, because as Catholics, Catholic Americans, we live in the United States, we are citizens of the United States, but ultimately, of course, our citizenship lies in heaven, and we also belong to a church that is universal. The claims it makes are universal. So I think that doesn't mean that we reject the United States. And I think there are some Catholics who are tempted to think that because America is not a Catholic society and that there's something fundamentally problematic about that. What I think the phrase Catholic American means is, as Catholics, we are called upon to transform the United States in a way that it more closely reflects not just the founding and the language of the Republic of Virtues, but also that we carry out the Second Vatican Council's mandate to transform the societies in which we live so that they conform more to the mind of Christ. That doesn't mean a theocracy. It doesn't mean setting up a Catholic republic or some sort of monarchy, Catholic monarchy or something like that. Mm-hmm. It simply means that it should be our appreciation of our faith and our understanding of the demands of our faith that we live out in the American public square, rather than falling into the trap of what you might call Kennedy Catholicism, whereby secular society and some of the secular trends in the United States transform our Catholicism so that it becomes little more than a vague Episcopalianism.
Sure. Orestes Brownson called them political atheists back in the 1860s, and he said if your faith doesn't affect what you do with others or in the public square in your job, then you're really not that different than an atheist.
Correct.
We'll leave it at that. I want to thank you again for your precision in the book. If we're trying to get rid of fuzzy thinking and think on these issues like the connection between economic freedom and religious freedom, then we need that kind of precise thinking using terms like a Catholic American, for instance. So, Dr. Samuel Gregg, I want to thank you for appearing on Faith and Reason today.
Thank you, John. Great, as always, to talk with you.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinheiro, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinheiro is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.